Welcome to episode 5 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley, and today's episode is a special one. Recording what I've come to learn about not only the final 2 years of Mark Twain's life on his birthday today, November 30th, it ties in perfectly with everything we wanted this series to be. New information on topics that we randomly discovered, we found interesting, and then we explored them further. So Samuel Langhorne Clemens, known to the world as Mark Twain, came to my hometown of Reading, Connecticut in the summer of 1908. And the draw there, and pretty much the magnet and reason for his exit from New York City, was Albert Bigelow Paine. That would become his biographer, and that was the purpose of Albert's connection with Mark Twain at that time period. And for Sam himself, and I'll go back and forth before calling him Sam or Twain, but I think there was a hope for a less chaotic and more enjoyable day-to-day existence in his life, something many of us in the northwest corner of Connecticut can relate to. So Albert needed less distraction during his conversations / interviews with Sam because he was collecting data that would eventually become the official biography of the world-traveled and world-famous Mark Twain. And as I said, Sam needed some R&R, and there was another draw as well. There was the opportunity for people in his life to visit him, and that was something very powerful in his life. He was at grandpa stage in life. He was 72, 73, and he had a following of girls. They were called the Angelfish, and as a whole, he called the Angelfish, had an aquarium, and there was a lot of letters back and forth in this time period between these 10 to 14-year-old girls and Sam, and this house became a huge focus of that. But let me just pull back for a second and talk about how this ties to the old story, new information theme. So I grew up in Reading. I had a library card, the Mark Twain Library. My grandfather was the unofficial historian of Reading. Town historians weren't a title in the 70s and 80s. And he had also plenty of friends in his circle that we'd consider historians now. And I never got the impression from them that Mark Twain's time in Reading, Connecticut was special. There was a portrait of him on the librarian's office at the library, a wood-carved steamboat in a glass-encased box on the way to the bathrooms, and Hal Foster, a local illustrator, had a comically themed Twain portrait of Connecticut's King Arthur hung on the sidewall next to the children's section. But his time in Reading was always noted in a subtle way. We were told that he came here, founded the library, and he died. As a kid raised by old-timers, I believed that too. What they said was true, and if you spent the hours of debating these topics, as they did with me, you would believe that as well. So, new information. So enter 2001 and Ken Burns. In 2001, the documentary of Twain's life by Ken Burns is released, and it includes his time in Reading, Connecticut. This was not really well known in the Twain world, and because I had some information on his time in Reading on my website, website I still have it today, historyofreading.net, and I had the email address to contact me, the floodgates of requests just opened, and it didn't start as a trickle. It was immediately a flood of emails and phone calls of people that wanted to know more about this time in Reading, Connecticut. So, it's 2001, I'm running a web design business, and I've been gaining a following on local history topics, and now Twain comes to the forefront. So that's how I got into discovering his time, not only in Reading, but in Connecticut and his life as a whole. So What I found was that his time in Reading was far more significant than anyone could imagine. And what was even better is that his time in Connecticut was extraordinary. The Hartford House and the Reading House are the only houses in the world custom made for either the family or himself. And in addition to that, I was able to find like 55 towns and cities with significant connections to his life and his friends. And the one that's my favorite in terms of connectivity is the mantle in the library at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. That came from Reading. It is a Scottish mantle that the family had custom made. It was donated in the 1950s by a member of the Banks family, which has a nice tie to Twain's time in Reading. Lawrence Banks was, like my grandfather, a historian in Reading, and when the original house, Mark Twain's house in Reading, burned in the 20s, the Banks family was the one that rebuilt the house that currently exists on that same foundation. So it was a nice tie to that. And then on the other side, there is this Deputy Banks. Early after his arrival to Reading, the house was robbed. And in September of 1908, and Deputy Banks was the one who apprehended the burglars. So it was a neat way to get into the archives of the Mark Twain Library, which he founded, and he immediately, coming to Reading, wanted the library to be a thing. He rented out a chapel that was being unused at the time. So he arrives in June, and by October, the chapel is fitted with books from his own collection and his friend's collection, and a librarian. So that was something that he felt very strongly about in terms of what a small community needs. And Reading at that time was a very small community. It was 1,200 people, and mostly farming. And it changed a bit when Twain arrived, because now, the small farming community has an express train from New York City to Reading. And I think within like the first 6 months, he has like 180 guests arrive. So he really puts Reading on the map in terms of knowledge of the world, in terms of there were reporters reporting on things that were happening in Reading almost every single day. So every major newspaper or publication in the world is covering how he feels about Reading. And as it turns out, he probably envisioned Reading being a summer house or just a house that he would visit every now and again, but he immediately falls in love when he gets to really seeing it and experiencing the quiet and the beauty of not only the location, but he was more of a naturalist than anyone really knew. And the house itself was just fantastic. It was something that people really had never seen before in the area. Imagine a house on a hill, not many trees. It has all of the modern amenities that no other house in the area had. It had running water. There were 2,000 gallon tanks of water in the rooftop, hidden underneath the roof, obviously, that provided running water. There were lights that no one else had. There was a telephone. It had everything that no one else had in the area. So it was a spectacle, and people would come from everywhere to see what it was. And he liked the fact that even though he didn't have full, let's call it, involvement in what it would look like, he didn't want that. He wanted just to have his secretary, Isabel Lyon, and his daughter Clara come up with something that they knew that he would like. And he said he wouldn't show up until it was completely finished and there was a cat purring on the hearth. And that's pretty much what happened. And when he got there, they had designed it like an Italian villa. And that was kind of a tie to losing his wife in Italy earlier on in that decade. And in talking to people about the house itself, he said, his wife, his name is Olivia, or Livy, how Livy would have loved this place and how her very soul would steep itself thankfully in this place. It's the tranquility, the deep stillness, this dreamy expanse of woodsy hill and valley. It is the most satisfactory house I am acquainted with and the most satisfactory situated. I have dismissed my stenographer and have entered upon a holiday whose other end is the cemetery. Unfortunately, that plays true. But in the next roughly 2 years, you have his life in some degree coming together, and a lot of people, as I noted earlier, would come and visit. And what I learned in the process of going through the records at the townhouse, probate records, as well as what was collected at the Mark Twain Library itself, and was that there was a lot of information that tied to worldly travel, because that's really what differentiates him from anyone of his time frame. He was born in 1835, and that's pretty much. And he's in that's in the middle of Missouri. It was Florida, Missouri. They eventually moved to Hannibal along the Mississippi River. So he is at a point in that moment in time in U.S. history where that's the center of our nation, at a time when the whole nation is transferring from east to west, and things are changing and people are coming, and he's experiencing all of that. And then, for some reason, by the time he's 20 years old, he decides that he wants to see more of the country. So he actually heads out into all the major cities that we have. And, you know, at that moment in time, there's not really trains. It's probably travel that he's made through stagecoaches. And, you know, he's in St. Louis. He's in New York City. He's in Philadelphia. He's in a lot more places than he should be at that time in America. So what he's pretty much getting is a look at a world that not everyone at that moment in time would see. And that plays into why he was such a great writer. He had experienced characters. He had experienced different places. And well, I think the quote that really ties to that is that in Innocents Abroad, which is one of his first works, he says that travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime. And he would come to own that, and that's what I learned, and that's what I found was special. By the time he passes in 1910, he had traveled 35 countries. Not one of them on an airplane, mind you. It's boat travel, very dangerous boat travel, and not to mention going to areas around the world that, you know, subjected him to different diseases and things of that nature. So that was something that was a surprise to me. But in terms of his time in Reading, the people that visit him were always a part of his life. Helen Keller is probably the best example. They were closer than most people know. I knew that they had connected over the course of time, but in doing the deep dive into the information that was available, that really surprised me, because when he's in Reading, they had met in 1895 when she was trying to raise funds to get to Radcliffe College, which is the women's college at Harvard. And they became friendly there, but she visits him again in Reading. And so a lot of things that happened in Reading close what I call historical loops. And this was probably the most special one, because they were so similar. And they are two individuals within history that basically will never be forgotten for what they were able to accomplish. And their friendship was so funny, because he treated her not as if she was handicapped or a freak. He treated her just the way that someone like her would want to be treated, like a normal person. Like, for instance, when they met at a luncheon in 1895, when she's trying to raise funds for going to Radcliffe, everyone after meeting her, and she had spent a considerable amount of time with him at that moment, would shake her hand, and surprisingly to them, she would, you know, shake their hand and say, "Thank you for coming, Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so." So Twain is, you know, different than most, obviously. And so when he is in line and it is his turn to, you know, say goodbye, he just passes by her quickly and pats her on the head. And she says through her translator, you know, "Thank you for coming, Mr. Twain." And that caught him funny, because she's like, how does she know that was me? So when she does visit Stormfield, which was his house in Reading, Connecticut, he asked her, and she said, "Well, it is that simple, Mr. Twain. I could smell you," meaning, you know, Twain was known to smoke 20 cigars a day. So all of us in the Twain world found that to be very funny and interesting. And the other things that came into play with his time in Reading was his daughter Jean. She returns. She had epilepsy, and they didn't really understand it at that moment in time. So she's able to come back and be a part of the family. She is a part of the wedding party of her sister Clara. Clara was the only daughter of Twain's to marry, and actually she actually had a child at Stormfield a little bit after his passing. And there's just so many different connections that we found, all because of Ken Burns' documentary that includes his time in Reading. And we have, we had, and we still have a lot of fun with it. Unfortunately, if I had someone to talk to today, it would be Heather Morgan. She's unfortunately passed. But what we found together was amazing. So when I got to the archives soon after Ken Burns' documentary, so I'm guessing it was probably 2003. It was just before Heather was coming to be the executive director at the library, and I found this article about this individual from Reading that went to Russia and other parts of Europe to see what they thought of Mark Twain, and what he found was this extraordinary love of his works. They felt that he projected the true American. So that was a big surprise, and what Heather found when she started were actually the Russian books. So not only did this guy, Bradley Kelly, go to Europe and the Ukraine and other parts of Russia, we started to exchange books with the Russian people. So that was a big surprise, and that led to, gosh, talks all over the Northeast at different universities and different areas that wanted to hear it. So that's something that we have that is special. The other thing that's special is that all the books that he donated to the early Mark Twain Library, we still have. And we had a laugh, but most of the books that the Mark Twain Library had were circulated to everyday people. And it wasn't until much later, the 50s or 60s, that it was realized that these were actually Mark Twain's books. And now they're in a cabinet in the original library upstairs. But also what's neat is because we had this research, because we made this knowledge available to the public, the New York Times came and they scanned everything. So everything now is available online, all because we found it and we shared it. And that's the important thing, as we've talked about in other episodes, is sharing history is so important because it opens up so many other different opportunities that you wouldn't imagine. So, you know, I'm more of a Mark Twain life person, and I obviously have read most of his books, but it's really about his life, and he was truly a rags-to-riches kind of story. He was born very poor. He was actually a premature baby by 2 months, so you can only imagine, you know, being premature 2 months in 1835, and you know, he had seven other brothers and siblings. Only three survived, including himself. So he was something of it's shocking not only that he survived, but then someone like Helen Keller had similar types of troubles early on, and they both persevered. And they're both individuals that no one will ever forget. They transcend every generation. And I think that's the extraordinary life that many of us hope to lead. And so that's my love of Mark Twain is really his life. And I continue to research and find new things all the time. I obviously use his quotes everywhere as we end our program every episode. That's a Mark Twain quote there. Always do right, and this will gratify some people and astonish you. That's a Mark Twain quote. And the other one that I used all the time in office was that if you have to eat a frog, do it first thing in the morning, and if you have to eat two, then eat the biggest one first. And that's proper, and that's true. So that's Mark Twain. Mark Twain and Connecticut are really something that should be projected better in tourism and culture. We have so many different assets to share with the world. Like I said earlier, I've connected 55 towns and cities with his life, and they're significant. I didn't go lowbrow and highbrow and everyone. I had to confirm that these towns and cities had either individuals or events that took place in his life that were ultra important. So that's a hope of mine as I move forward in my ventures to bring tourism with Mark Twain themed events and locations to light. And we'll see how that works out. So next episode is going to be just as fun for me as this one has been. I'll be talking with another great writer, and that's Carol Asher, about her discovery, which was Russian Jews that came to our Ellsworth section of the northwest corner of Connecticut here in Sharon. Carol lives on Mowley Road, and that's where a lot of them started. There was a Belgian Jewish millionaire that funded this around 1907, and he thought that bringing Jews from the Russian sections of Europe here to become successful, respected citizens of America was something that he wanted to fund, and Carol took this topic and ran with it, and her book and that story is fantastic, so I hope everyone will enjoy that. It's a story that ties to so many families that we still know in the present day. I mean, the Paley family, Paley Market, like they're tied into it. The Prindle family, they're tied into it. I mean, the Arnoff. I mean, Arnoff is in there. I mean, there's a lot more. For me, it was Marcus Derry, because I was down in the Danbury area. And a lot of them were dairy farmers, but a lot of them moved on to other ventures. And most of Aminia, New York, was founded by these same families as they generationally moved forward. So I think you're going to enjoy that, and I hope you enjoyed this one. Talking about Mark Twain on his birthday is something special. So until next time, be well, and always do right, because this will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information, hosted by Brett Colley, is produced at the facilities of WHDD, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.